is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer Mark Haber. Haber is the operations manager and a bookseller at Brazos Bookstore in Houston, Texas, and really one of the great literary tastemakers of our time, guiding writers, editors, readers, and critics to some of the most incredible and often underappreciated writing happening today, writing that is often coming to us in translation from other languages and other cultures. He's the author of the 2008 short story collection Deathbed Conversions that was subsequently translated into Spanish and published in a bilingual edition in 2017 as Melville's Beard by Editorial Argonautica. His literary criticism of Cesar Ayra, Enrique Villamata, Andres Barba, Guadalupe Natel, and many others can be found in many publications from Lit Hub, Music and Literature, and The Rumpus to the Brazos Bookstore website itself. He has served both as a juror for the National Endowment of Arts Translations Grants and as a judge for the Best Translated Book Award. Mark Haber is here today on Between the Covers to talk about his debut novel, Reinhardt's Garden, out from Coffeehouse Press and longlisted for this year's Penn Hemingway Award. Kirkus Reviews says of Reinhardt's Garden, "With a philosophical bent and nary a paragraph break, the novel evokes Gertrude Stein, contemporary European and South American writers like Matias Enar, Roberto Bolaño, and Cesar Ayra, with the quixotic atmosphere of Werner Herzog films like Fitzcarraldo. The story is rich with stem winders on the intersection of melancholy with lust, religion, debauchery, and more. In form and language, his story entertainingly evokes the mood it's chasing, interior, mercurial, implacable." Carlos Fonseca adds, "Reinhardt's Garden simultaneously recalls the great tradition of 19th century European travelers like Alexander von Humboldt, Aimé Bonpland, and Charles Darwin, as well as the critical Latin American rewritings of seminal expeditions. The echoes of Cesar Ayra's An Episode in the Life of a Landscape Painter, Juan José Sayer's The Witness, or even Benedetto Zama resound with such strength that at times we can imagine Haber to be a Latin American writer. This subtle yet brilliant act of mimicry is perhaps the author's intention all along, to take his character's obsession to the threshold where their fantasies confuse themselves with reality, to the limit at the end of the journey where Europe finds itself confronted in the middle of the Gualeguaychú forest, not by the dreamed Eden it had envisioned, but the reflection of its discontents. Revising Goya, one dares to think out loud, the dreams of reason do produce monsters, but it is always better to face them through the lens of philosophical humor." Welcome to Between the Covers, Mark Haber.
Delighted to be here, David. Thank you so much, and thank you for that amazing introduction. I'm like, who is this guy you're talking about?
Well, I particularly love the Carlos Fonseca description of your book.
That was probably the favorite thing I'd read about my book so far, I think. He really nailed it, I think.
Yeah, and the intersection and the interaction of Europe and Latin America is sort of the nexus of your influences, but also the intersection and nexus of the plot and the characters in the book. And I agree that the book, to me, reads very much like that of a certain strain of Latin American writer. But rather than calling it an act of mimicry, I might call it instead a love letter to literature.
Sure.
Particularly your own literary loves and influences. And I think of something you said in your review of a book by Enrique Villamatas that made me think of you, even though you said it. Villamatas belongs to that clan who believe literature is in constant conversation with itself. He is a quote-unquote literary writer in that he is absorbed with literature. Writers and writing are the major preoccupations of his work. So I was hoping we could start here.
Absolutely.
Not with the story, but with how those writers you love have influenced the book, whether that be its form and length or the type of sentences and its syntax.
Absolutely. This book would not exist without translated literature. It just wouldn't. I'd be a writer. I've wanted to be a writer since I was 17, but it would probably be some kind of, I don't know, diluted attempt at like Saul Bellow or something,
yeah.
Who is an influence, I think, as far as the mix of high and low culture that I try and do in my writing. But yeah, it's one of these things where I think any art you steal. You steal what you love, and then you make it your own, that kind of cliche. Basically, the shape and the size of the style of the book itself is definitely influenced by Ira. Those tiny books that are compact, but so much happens in them. And, of course, very influenced by Thomas Bernhard, a European writer, an Austrian writer. And I didn't mention, or I haven't since the book's come out, and I'm glad you brought that up, is Villamatas. I always forget what an influence he is. And for him, it would be the playfulness, the kind of really literary, thoughtful playfulness. Mm. And when I say literary, it's not kind of in a snobby way. It's meant to invoke that sense of a love of literature and books, and books being in dialogue with each other. And I wanted if someone to read my book and say, oh, I see you've read Bernhard, or I see you like Bolaño and all that, that's the biggest compliment in the world. You know, it is.
Well, I wasn't going to go here, but that you mentioned Saul Bellow. I loved in one interview you talked about how Bellow, you consider a foreign writer in some regards.
I do.
Because he's one of the few people that you name who's an American writer as an influence. So
yes.
tell us why Bellow is also not an American writer.
Okay, sure. So just a little bit about his life is that, you know, he came from Russian immigrants. His parents spoke Russian and Yiddish in their household. And initially, they moved to Canada. And I think when he was about 7 or 8, if I'm correct, they moved to Chicago. So he grew up in a household that spoke Russian and Yiddish. And that's not just a language, but a sensibility. It's a sense of humor. It's the way of looking at things. In a current example, Larry David's sensibility is very, very Jewish. It just is. I was raised Jewish, but it just in a cultural way, I see that. I can see Larry David. I can read Saul Bellow, and I never met them, but I'm like, I know these people. I know there's a sense of cynicism, of laughing at oneself, you know, self estrangement from oneself in a sense, and so that definitely is an influence. And Saul Bellow doesn't strike me. Even though his books take place in the Berkshires, in New York, in Chicago, I mean, he is a very American writer, and at the same time, he's not. Hmm. Yeah, I think the two kind of coexist.
Yeah. To return to Ira and the shortness of the book.
Yes.
I love that Ira writes books that are, 80 to 120 pages?
Me too.
And that they're called novels. They're not called long short stories or novellas.
Yes.
And we see that also with Bolaño, with Distant Star, By Night in Chile. We see that with Cristina Rivera Garza.
Yes.
Most of her books. We see that with Yuri Herrera. We even see it with some British writers like Max Porter, but we don't see that happening in the United States.
No.
Or very rarely in the United States.
Very rarely.
And I guess I was curious as a bookseller,
yeah.
Maybe you have some thoughts on that. Why is this novel length, which we completely resist calling a novel, and we diminish it in the United States if a length comes out like that, unless it comes from somewhere else.
Right.
Why doesn't that exist as a form when so many beloved people are actually writing in it?
Yeah. I think part of it, and I could be wrong because I don't have an MFA, but I believe it's part of this MFA that says the book should be this length, it should have this look. When you walk right into Brazos, the first thing you see is the display of new hardcover fiction. And that's not going to have a lot of books like Cristina Rivera Garza or Yuri Herrera. These books come out in paperback. They're paperback originals. So that right there in a customer's sense is already diminished. And I think that the MFA programs, the impression I get is that there's a certain way that you do things. There's this box you stay in. The book should be between 270 to 350 pages, unless you're writing the big American novel. And so I think people get in these mind frames. I have good friends that graduated with MFAs and they're writers, and they tell me, Mark, I wish – I'm still trying to unlearn the things that I learned in my MFA,
yeah.
My master's.
I always presumed it was capitalism, that it was like –
I think that's part of it too.
I mean, how many books that actually come out that are between 250 and 300 pages? Like it's weird.
Yeah.
The large
and
number
people want
of
their
books.
Money's worth. I think you're correct. That's part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So another noteworthy thing of your book that has a literary pedigree is that this novel – is all in one paragraph.
Yes.
So we have, there's no place to stop.
No.
There's the beginning, and then we get kicked out at the end.
Yes.
So that has a long and storied literary pedigree, which is also uncommon in the United States.
Yes.
So maybe you could just touch on who among those people who have written in this form come to mind.
Of course.
For you.
Yes. So I had like two rules when I set out to write this book, and this is kind of a long way of answering your question, is that I wanted it to be an unbroken paragraph. Maybe that's just the one rule I had. I had just finished reading Laszlo Krasznahorkai's short double book kind of novellas or a pair of stories called The Last Wolf and A Herman. I have actually to this day still not read Herman, but I read The Last Wolf, and that's actually a single sentence. And I knew I wanted the book – those were the two rules. I wanted the book to take place in a jungle, and I wanted it to be an unbroken paragraph. That's, in a way, not really the challenge I set for myself. It was just an aesthetic choice that I wanted to do. And this goes back to the of course, tradition of probably the best known is Thomas Bernhard, whose novels are almost all just these diatribes, these monologues that are unbroken paragraphs. And it's a stylistic choice, and it's a choice of wanting the voice to kind of be the main character in a story. And I love voice-driven fiction. I love where the voice is its own character. And so influenced by that, a huge influence was By Night in Chile by Bolaño. I've had that book on my nightstand for probably 10 years, and I always pick it up every couple of years and reread it. Because I learned from reading that, By Night in Chile and The Last Wolf, how much you can do in a very dense but small space. And I taught myself while I was writing Reinhardt's Garden that by kind of setting myself those boundaries, I actually liberated myself, and I was able to go anywhere I wanted by not leaving the margins of the page, so to speak.
One of the ways I would characterize the way you really make this distinctively Mark Haber,
yeah,
is that while I open the book and I'm immediately in this very strong voice,
yeah,
like when we're with Thomas Bernhard, we're in a very distinctive consciousness.
Yes.
But with Bernhard, who's also funny,
yes,
there's also a sense of maybe sometimes gasping for air because you're trapped in a consciousness,
right?
And it's very recursive and interior and hilarious,
absolutely.
But at the same time, also hermetic.
Yes.
And your book feels very much somehow to be a voice-driven book that hurtles its way forward, that has a lot of outward-facing, worldly, eventful things happening.
Yes.
So there is. Even though it's all coming through consciousness, we're not in like a traditional scene. It feels to me like we are also being told a globe-trotting story at the same time.
Yes, you nailed it, David. Is that the two differences between this? So the Bernhard influence is unmistakable. I wear it proudly. Is I wanted the book to be, and this is just my personality. I think it's sillier than Bernhard. Bernhard is hilarious, but it's also kind of this almost this gallows humor. You're like you're almost like laughing from the void. And I wanted there to be exterior action. So in Bernhard's books, it's all in the mind, really. And if things happen, they're mostly very, very psychological. And in my book, it's still voice-driven. It's very interior, but things are happening. People are being chased. There's jungle. There's Russia. There's action.
So let's orient people to the story of Reinhardt's Garden. Since
sure.
We are in both Croatia, Russia, and in South America, what is the story and circumstance? What's your elevator pitch for Reinhardt's Garden?
My elevator pitch, which does not do it justice, you know, because they say keep it short, it was, it's a comedy about melancholy,
yeah.
Which it is, but it's many other things, I think. So it's 1907, and you're following really three, but essentially two Croatian men and some people they've picked up along the way in South America looking for this lost philosopher. Today he might have been called a self-help writer. You don't know whether he wrote about, you know, melancholy or happiness. You're just not really sure, but they're looking for him because not the narrator, but the protagonist, Jacob, is obsessed with melancholy. And so he's looking for this man who wrote all of these fantastic books, he believes, on melancholy. So the book opens in 1907. That's the present time. They're in the jungle, and then there's many, many flashbacks to their time in Europe, which brought them to the jungle and being threatened by local tribes and madness and starvation and all those hijinks.
And the narrator is Jakob Reinhardt's
yes.
factotum,
yes.
his personal assistant.
Yes.
So sort of a I mean, Sancho Panza or Max Brod to Kafka.
Absolutely. Oh, great. Yeah, that's a great analogy or great comparison. Yeah. And so it's being told through a person who may or may not be sick. He might be a bit of a neurotic, you know. He may be sick. You just don't know. And it's being told through his eyes, and he absolutely idolizes. I've said Jacob. I've said Yakov. I've read three different ways. So I've written a novel, and
how
I don't—
How do you say it?
When I started the book tour, I looked it up, and I've heard that in Croatia you can pronounce it like Jacob, but with the V. So then I said, I would guess it's not Yakov, it's Jacob. I think Chad Post from Open Letter, when he was talking about it on a podcast, said Yakov. So I don't think there's any wrong way.
Okay, let's say it all the ways.
Okay.
During the conversation.
Yeah, okay.
We'll
the different ways, yeah.
Unless you have a preference.
I have no preference.
Okay.
Yeah. when I started the book, it was the first two pages are really how you read it. I really didn't change anything. And I said, oh, I'll have this minor character. He'll come up as a recurring joke. And he's going to write a treatise on melancholy. And every few pages, I'll go to him and kind of refer to him. There he is, scribbling in his journal when all these bad things are happening. But, I mean, by the second day, I was like, oh, he's the one to pay attention to. He's the one that has something going on there.
And there's this weird issue of following, because we have this character who's telling the story who is following Yakov or Jakov or Jacob.
Jacob, right.
Jacob. Because he believes he's a genius. He believes Reinhardt's a genius who is in the progress of writing this treatise of melancholy that our narrator has never actually seen.
Yeah.
But Reinhardt is also following the person who wrote the greatest work of melancholy, sort of the El Dorado or the Fountain of Youth quest that they go on
right.
in South America, is to try to discover this disappeared writer. So we have our narrator following a possible genius following an established genius
yes.
of melancholy. But I think one of the ways in which – I know comedy is hard to talk about and how to write comically, but I think one of the places you really exploit comedy in this book is the difference between the way the narrator feels about Reinhardt and uh-huh. the way the reader feels about Reinhardt. Would you say that's true?
I would say that's very true. And what's great is, like, oh, when you write a book and then people say things, and you're like, oh, I guess you're right. Like someone said, oh, the book kind of, you know, explores colonialism. I'm like, you're right, it does. So what you're saying is absolutely true, and I haven't looked at that. But yeah, I think the reader is going to have feelings, or does have feelings, about Yakov that are not seen through the eyes of the storyteller. I mean, he absolutely idolizes him, and really, Jacob can do no wrong.
Yeah. I wanted to follow up on that a little, because in your collection of stories, Deathbed Conversions, later called Melville's Beard or La Barba de Melville, we begin with a note to the reader where we learn the narrator has written these stories, quote, under the observation of a doctor, Dr. Heinrich Audubon, and that this observation is happening because the narrator has suffered a quote-unquote mental malady. And many of the stories that follow have characters who are obsessed or have a compulsion or who are manic. And you could definitely say this is true of Reinhardt, of Yakov Reinhardt.
Yes.
That he's obsessed, mm-hmm. possibly manic. So I guess I wanted to hear about what attracts you to this type of person as character, and maybe as a writer, what it affords you, what yes. allows you to explore by choosing characters who are both under observation
sure.
and whose mental capacity is under question.
Absolutely. So I think writers find themes, or themes find them, and they find things that just the it's just kind of their obsessions. They're almost unconscious. And I love the idea of time periods like Kafka and sanitariums. And I love this idea of extreme obsessed, characters that are maybe a little bit maniacal. I can't really do subtlety. I wish I could. I see writers that do very quiet writing, and I'm what appeals to me and what I think my strength is writing characters that are on the high end. They're very obsessed. They're very driven, and the reader usually is kind of in the backseat going, wow, this person is not, you know. I think Saul Bellow called them high IQ morons. You know, I love people who are really, really smart and intelligent, but their entire obsession is almost like an act of self-sabotage, where what they're doing is to the detriment of themselves and, obviously, in Reinhardt's garden, everyone around them. And, of course, you can look at, current situations where people have blind faith in someone and it's not good for anyone. We can leave it at that, but those characters interest me. They really do. I like the extreme. And when you go into that world, you find a lot of ways to explore comedy, you know?
Well, let's hear a little bit of the prose.
Sure. It's about a little bit past halfway in the book, and this is when and the reader knows very early on that that Jacob has a love for cocaine, and this is kind of a bit of the story of how this happened. He was going through what in the book is called his gray period, which is depression or something different than melancholy. But okay, so I'll just begin. This was also around the time Jacob received his first prescription for cocaine in an attempt, said Dr. Schmidt, to balance Jacob's moods and, we hoped, alleviate the curtain that had fallen across the stage of my master's mind. And Jacob's renewed exuberance for his masterwork, as well as his discovery of Ivan Ilyich, coincided with his use of cocaine, what he called a miracle drug. Cocaine is a miracle drug, Jacob insisted, a conduit to the gods. Cocaine had once again made me see the full breadth of my life's work. Cocaine has caused melancholy to flower inside me like a field of edelweiss, but a melancholy more sumptuous and impregnable and cosmic than any I've known. And as he raved, I would sit or stand, enraptured by his moods, by the emphatic belief in his own sublime ability. And I can't recall if the cocaine came before Ivan Ilyich or if Ivan Ilyich came before the cocaine, the cocaine assisting in a deeper reading into Ivan Ilyich, or the reading of Ivan Ilyich somehow encouraging him to ingest more cane, for both had profound influences on one another, but the two were conflated. So Jacob's use of cocaine in his reading of Ivan Ilyich appeared as a single act conjured by destiny. And his sermons ranged from the high to the middle to the low, infinite spiels replete with menace and spleen and rancor, now peppered by frequent and subsequent breaks for cocaine. So afterward, he could continue with ever more expansive spiels of menace and spleen and rancor. His diatribes concerning Klein and the Kleinians especially. These took on an imminent aspect of horror and madness, accusations and suspicions, and plots of pure conjecture, spewing uncontrollably and reeking of paranoia, yet with the slightest hint of truth, since I hadn't met Klein, but had, of course, met my master. And presumably I knew my master's soul, was intimate with my master's soul, and furthermore, trusted my master's soul, and as such, wasn't bothered much by the consumption of cocaine, because if Jacob claimed they were all brutes and bastards and intellectual derelicts, then by all accounts they were, and who was I to say any different? Mornings I would pace the hall outside to study, keen to begin dictation and once again fill the notebooks of his ever-growing library, or perhaps finally put some order to the assemblage of shelves packed with the studies he dictated to me, thousands of the most beautiful thoughts and aphorisms and philosophies on that most somber of human emotions. As Wagner resounded like the boots of an approaching army, I waited in the hall with its ludicrous incline and haphazard angles, all the worse for being intentional. The new castle, the second Stuttgart castle, preposterous even in its unfinished state. In one sense, the muddle of Jacob's radiant mind reflected in the pitched interiors, in the halls that slowly narrowed, in the landing seen but forever out of reach, in the corners that caught and twisted more ankles than I cared to count. Yet his mind, and my love for his mind, superseded any concerns for architecture. For what are the crude elements of the earth when placed beside the infinite? My desire for traditional dictation, however, was quickly hindered by Jacob's cocaine-addled thoughts. His desire to swim the replicated pond or hire mediums to speak with his sister or perhaps take a moonlit stroll around Stuttgart estate or even perhaps further into town towards the Schatzplatz or the Beer Garden or the Bruno Heinzel Tavern where the socialist democrats ensconced among the benches spent their days drinking foamy beer and arguing because Jacob enjoyed nothing more than mocking the locals, the bourgeois and the proletariat both. Since he belonged to neither, insisted he was simply an artist and a psychologist and a scientist combined. Thus, the bourgeois and the proletariat were alien beings to him, simply herds of humans with fixed labels, not unlike the Kleinians or the Eurofuturists or the Marxists especially, who lately huddled among the coffee houses of the Schatzplatz to argue and stomp their feet. Jacob's eyes trembled, wet from the cold, tears swam down both cheeks, for he forbade the use of a coat or even my bringing a coat, for the chill he insisted did him good, the same harsh chill that invigorated Jacob as he performed his Buddhist meditations in the study with the windows open and wearing not a stitch of clothing save his favorite smock. Indeed, something inside Jacob had loosened, maybe good, maybe bad. And if he had been ambitious before, he was more ambitious now. But it was a reckless ambition that skirted the abyss and made me frightened for our future. Having copied the death of Ivan Ilyich longhand three or four times, Jacob instructed me to buy all the copies available in Stuttgart, every translation, German, Polish, the original Russian, and while I was at it, I should stop by Dr. Schmidt's to pick up another prescription of cocaine. For one shouldn't delve into one's most brilliant work only to come up short, to see the horizon, for example, to espy one's triumphs, for example, to grasp the mantle, for example, only to stumble in the final stretch. At length, he concluded what I should have seen coming. he must visit Tolstoy himself, and I, of course, would accompany him. And perhaps he would pray with Tolstoy and share ideas with Tolstoy and ultimately find communion with Tolstoy. For Tolstoy was a kindred spirit who was able to communicate the vagaries of melancholy through the lesser art of fiction. Even though I detest fiction, he said, even though I loathe to read fiction, he said, even though fiction has grown adults playing make-believe and dress-up, he said, Tolstoy has captured the modern state of melancholia. The death of Ivan Ilyich was placed in my hands for a reason, he stated. And as soon as he learned that Tolstoy had abandoned literature for a spiritual calling, it was like Tolstoy's estate, Yasnaya Polyana, had been waiting for him all along. For his abandonment of literature was proof, Jacob attested, of the telepathic connection the two of them shared.
We've been listening to Mark Haber read from the Reinhardt's Garten. One book we could add to the list of short books is The Death of Ivan Ilyich.
Yes. And that was a nod to kind of the novella, to the short book that, I mean, it's obviously a celebrated story. It's world-renowned. But it's kind of forgotten with the big ones, you know, Anna Karenina and, of course, War and Peace. So that was kind of an intentional – some things when you write a book and you realize, oh, that just happened. That was the magic of literature. But that was intentional, was putting a little book in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, one of the things that I do love, which you also do in this section you just read, is blurring the fictional and the non-fictional in a way that – is hard to parse as a reader.
Yeah.
You play it straight.
Yes.
So Yakov, he's going to go off to visit Tolstoy.
Yes.
And you also mention Yakov's nemesis, the psychologist Otto Klein.
Yes.
And because you render these fictional historical characters in the same register as the real ones.
Yes.
I found myself with notes as I was reading Reinhardt's Garten. I had a note to myself, research Otto Klein. Who later, of course, I learned is really invented. But he also shares, you know, I thought of Otto Rank, who was the psychologist for Henry Miller and Anais Nin.
Ah.
Who, so you have these names that have like these resonances.
Yes.
But then also made me wonder, even though we're visiting Tolstoy, who's real.
Right.
Was the plague of wild dogs that they encounter there, which seemed like it might have been a significant event in Tolstoy's life as it was destroying his estate. Was that true?
Right.
But I guess I want to hear more about doing this.
Sure.
As a general phenomenon.
Yeah.
And then also if there are our predecessors that come to mind, because some come to mind for me, and I'd just be curious what came to mind for you.
Yeah, okay, so as far as mixing the real and the fictional is something I love to do, and it's not meant to try and fool the reader or make people go down these rabbit holes looking up for things, but it's part of the fabric or the tapestry of the story I'm trying to tell, where I want these things that seem like almost beyond believable to be kind of mixed in with things that actually did happen or people that existed. So, of course, all these wild, the surf smuts that are running rampant on Tolstoy's estate was invented. And when I was writing the book, that was something that when I wrote, I actually was laughing out loud. Like, okay, I looking at the book, that's probably the part that tickles me most, is this man trying to trap wild dogs on Tolstoy's estate. Just is, to me, it's so absurd. But back to that, I do try and mix the real and the fictional, and I did that in my short stories, and the new novel I've coming out in a year or two from Coffee House also mixes that. So it's a style that, I guess it's a style, but it's definitely a choice I do because I like mixing the real and the fictional to kind of just create a tapestry. And so it can maybe give nods or maybe like kind of finger-pointing signs to the reader that, you know, he's not Nietzsche, but he's kind of Nietzsche-like, or he's not this person, and he's not Kierkegaard, but he's kind of in that realm. So I kind of incorporate it, or I compare it to painting, where I want to use my own colors, but I'm going to use a little bit of red or blue, so you go, okay, that was Prague in the 30s, or this was that, to give it some historical context, even if it's fictional.
Well, it's great having you on the show.
This has been a really pleasure. I'm honored. I'm a big fan. Thank you, David.
We're talking today to Mark Haber about his book, Reinhardt's Garten, from Coffee House Press. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listener-supported community radio.
Oh, to feel good.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
Good morning and welcome to Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch, the library lady. And joining me soon from a remote location will be Emma Jackson Ford and O.B. Hill. But at the moment, I'm the only one in the studio, so it's just you and me right now. This is National Poetry Month, and that's what we're dedicating this program to. We opened with the poem, The Negro Speaks of the River. It was read by the poet Langston Hughes. It is a part of a CD set of